Sportsnet 650.
Ian, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm very well. I'm glad I didn't haul my carcass to Winnipeg.
Yeah, thankfully.
That's a veteran move.
This is the one road trip you did not want to go on. Two games that have been pretty ugly for the Canucks.
Yeah, and predictably so. It was that game in Calgary was so important to them, coming after the loss at home against Philadelphia, and you know that it was a chance to kind of slow the negativity or brighten things a bit, because I think we all knew that things were going to be tough without Horvat, and to have that game sort of in their hands halfway through the third period and then come away with nothing, I think kind of accelerated the problems, exacerbated, I guess would be a better word. And that result last night in Winnipeg, that was wholly predictable. You know, Winnipeg is a powerhouse team, and especially at home, and the Canucks piling on more bad news with the Berchi injury, they just never had a chance. They would have to play almost a perfect game to beat a team like Winnipeg, and they were far from perfect.
And part of that, too, is goaltending, right? And goaltending has been really solid for the Canucks to start the season, at least so far. But if you look at the last 12 starts Jacob Markstrom's had, only four of those starts, his save percentage has been north of 900. He's going to have to be better if he's going to be the starting goalie here long-term, doesn't he?
He does. Better than he's been the last 12 games, for sure. But on the whole, I didn't look at what his save percentages adjusted now after last night, but I think it was 916 going in. So on the whole, he's given them good goaltending. It's just unrealistic to think that a guy, whether it's he or Anders Nilsson, who was you know, even hotter at the start of the year, is somehow going to maintain that. That's just not realistic. The problem with the goalies right now is neither one is particularly sharp. Anders Nilsson needed to come up with a save in Calgary, and he didn't. And these guys, for the most part, have been allowing three or more goals per night. And the Canucks just aren't going to win those games right now because they don't have enough in their lineup to score four. So this is going to have to be, you know, a 2-1 team. Maybe on a good night, they're a 3-2 team. But they're not going to be a 5-4 or 4-3 team right now with the people that they're missing.
Ian, with regards to the lack of offense, did it surprise or maybe even disappoint you that Nikolai Goldobin was in the press box for a second straight game?
It surprised me. I wouldn't say disappointed because I don't really have a rooting interest, and we have to strive always to keep things in perspective. And Nikolai Goldobin, if he'd only scored four last night, maybe they'd have gotten a point out of the game. It was a curious decision. Certainly was an unpopular decision. As I said on the post-game show last night, it looks like something that the team just overthought, that Travis Green and staff overthought, because it was a fairly simple assessment. If you look at Sven Berchi coming out and the style of player he was and the style of player that Nikolai Goldobin is versus Alex Burmistrov, it just seemed to be a no-brainer to put him in. There's lots of reasons that they may not have, including, I know a popular one last night was popular theory was that they're showcasing him. If anyone's going to give the Canucks anything significant for Alex Burmistrov, I'd be stunned. You see guys constantly clearing waivers. There are very few trades. It's very much a buyer's market right now. So I don't know if that's the case or not. I have a hard time thinking that Travis Green, the way he has coached this team, is going to knowingly put an inferior player in his lineup just to quote-unquote showcase him. I think he must, in fact, I'm pretty sure that Travis Green thought, for whatever reason, that Burmistrov would give them a better chance to win than Goldobin. And Burmistrov, let's face it, wasn't the problem. But just as Goldobin was not going to be good enough for them to win that game, Burmistrov wasn't going to be bad enough for them to cost that game. It was just the team was inferior to the one they were playing.
We did hear from Elliot Friedman in his 31 Thoughts that the Canucks may be trying to get rid of or at least trade Alex Bremistrov one way or the other. Do you think it would happen sooner rather than later, maybe before the holiday freeze here?
Well, if they can, they will. But again, I seriously doubt that there's a market for Alex Bremistrov. I mean, somebody might take him. Maybe you get a sixth or you get somebody's minor leaguer that's far down the depth chart. But I just don't see there being a market for him. I think the most likely scenario is that the Canucks would waive him and they'd end up with another player in Utica on a one-way deal.
We're in conversation with Ian McIntyre from Sportsnet.ca here on the Playbook with Sat and John at Sportsnet 650. Ian, I did want to ask about Eric Goodbranson a little bit because he is getting closer to a return. We expect that he's going to play at some point this month before the Christmas freeze comes in. Now, Alex and I were kicking this around yesterday and we were saying that we're always assuming that Goodbranson's going to get dealt, but I wouldn't be surprised that if he does end up getting an extension here, or at least talking about an extension come the new year. Do you get the sense that the team is going to properly reevaluate the situation? Do you think they have their minds made up about what they want to do with him?
No, I think there's a lot of moving parts here. Right now, it's hard to see a fit for him, but there's still almost 3 months before the trade deadline, or 2.5. So there's still time to sort of see where he might fit and where other guys might fit and what the market might be for somebody else. You know, the problem isn't really Eric Goodbranson. If you look at it strictly from a numbers standpoint, both in terms of players and salary, the problem is the numbers. And I know that maybe doesn't make sense, but they can't afford to have Goodbranson as a third pairing guy, in my opinion. They can't afford to have him as a third pairing guy at, you know, $4.5 million or $4 million. But if suddenly there's a market and somebody really wants one of their other defensemen, then that creates a space for him. I don't know that it moves him up from the third pairing, but it makes him more important to the team if somebody else goes for, you know, a high draft pick or help at forward. So there is, I think, a lot of assessment still to be done on that. But I find it hard to see how he's going to fit in long term unless he was willing to do another, you know, 1 year contract. But why would Eric Goodbranson do that? You know, he's going to be a UFA. He is going to be sought after no matter what people think of his flaws or limitations. He is going to be a guy who would get a lot of interest as a UFA and a lot of money as a UFA. So I don't see how he does the Canucks a favor by signing a short-term deal to give them more time to figure out what they want to do. I think they're going to have to make a big decision on Goodbranson before the deadline. And it's either going to be to pay him or to trade him, because he's not the kind of player that this organization or any organization these days can afford to let walk for nothing. Given the assets that Jim Benning spent to get Goodbranson a couple of years ago, they can't be left with zero from this trade.
That's the way I see it too, Ian. And I wouldn't be surprised that they consider signing him more seriously, especially if the trade offers aren't great. Because it's one thing you have to get something for him, but if you're going to be left with essentially 20 cents on the dollar, it may feel like it's better to just sign him than trading him for next to nothing if they feel like his market value is not really good enough in the trade market. Could you sort of see that being the case?
Well, it depends what they sign him
right
for, Sat. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not signing him to a six-year deal for
right
whatever, $27 million or whatever the number would be. Maybe I'd sign him to a three-year deal. But again, then why should Goodbranson take that? Because he's got the hammer here. You know, the leverage is his. One thing that's interesting, though, or a little wrinkle about all these deals, including Bo Horvat's, and Bo Horvat is as cemented to the core of this team as anybody, and his deal does not have any trade restrictions. So, if you're going to sign him, Eric Goodbranson, then you have to make sure that you at least have the option to move him. And if he plays better If he finds his game and becomes, say, a second pairing guy, somebody who's going to give you, you know, 20 to 22 minutes and have physical presence every night, then that's a contract you can move, and you're going to get bidders for it. But if he goes the other way and is very much a supporting player in a depth role, then any kind of long-term deal is going to be hard to move. But I don't see any way that you can sign him and bind yourself to him with a no-trade clause. I think you'd, at the very least, you'd have to give yourself some options after you sign him.
Brock Besser just continues to score no matter who he plays with. And doesn't part of you sort of wish that you would have seen what Besser would have looked like had he played with the Twins in their prime?
Yeah, it would have been something, because as Henrik has said a couple of times, Brock Besser's the best finisher that he's ever played with. And of course, he played with his brother 1 year. Daniel got 40, and you know, Ryan Kesler 1 year had 40. He played with Marcus Naslund, although I don't know how, I can't really remember how much the Twins actually skated with Marcus Naslund. It wasn't very often, but Naslund was a tremendous finisher for a 3 or 4 year period as well. And so the fact that he's saying that Besser is better than any of those guys, it makes you, yeah, makes you wonder, could he have got 60 with them? Certainly the years that the Sedins were winning scoring titles, 50 would have been, if you could have transported Besser into his prime right then, 50 would have been possible. But the good thing is they've still got a whole lot of prime years of Brock Besser to come. He looks like a guy who shoots well enough and is so smart in the offensive zone that I think he's going to score pretty much no matter who he's playing with. Obviously, if he has great setup, man, it's going to help him score more goals. But I don't see Besser being kind of line mate dependent. I think he's just his style of game, that he's going to find space in the offensive zone to get his shot off, no matter who he's playing with. He is a marvelous talent, and I was impressed by him last night, as I have been all season. Mm-hmm. And I was a little surprised as well when I looked and saw that he basically is on the same pace that Patrick Laine was a year ago, when everybody was raving about Laine and the second coming of Mike Bossy. Well, Brock Besser's scoring at just as impressive a clip. And if you look at the players surrounding him, the circumstances of the teams, I'd argue that he's having a better rookie season than what Patrick Laine had a year ago to this point.
50, maybe 60 goals if Brock was playing with Henrik and Daniel in their prime. I'm just wondering now, who's got a DeLorean here in the Lower Mainland so we can make this thing come to life? I think every Canucks fan would love to see that. We're joined by Ian McIntyre from Sportsnet.ca. Hey, Ian, there's 6 games here for the Vancouver Canucks before they hit the holiday break. How many wins do you think they can squeeze out of this one? They do play the Sharks twice.
I think it's hard to see how they're going to win any games, but I'm not saying they're going to lose all 6. I think they'll find a way to win a couple. I can't emphasize enough how difficult it is for them right now. There's just so much that's gone against them lately, the injuries, the travel before that, emotions. Now they're going to be, just as it's harder to play from behind in a game, now they're playing from behind in the standings. And they're not really going to get a chance to rest. I know that they don't have back-to-backs. They've got days between these games. But if you look at, say, Wednesdays, for example, the Nashville Predators haven't played since Friday and will not have played since Friday. They're going to be the more rested team than the Canucks are. So it's going to be a real challenge. If I'm going to guess, I'm going to say they're going to find a way to win 2 games, but they're going to have to play awfully well to win any games these days. Sportsnet 650.